Mini episode 987 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge mini episode number 987. This is FDH managing partner Rick Morris here. And it's quite a coincidence that it's number 987 because we have a gentleman on the show today. I've really been looking forward to doing this segment, who came into the league in 1987, the National Football League, the second pick in the draft. And I have to say, again, for anybody who is a child of the 80s or the 90s, I think anybody would agree with me, one of the dominant players coming off the edge, I think, that any of us have seen in our lifetimes. One heck of a career for this gentleman, somebody who really came in and justified that second pick overall, being a five-time Pro Bowler, three-time first-team All-Pro, two-time AFC Defensive Player of the Year, a gentleman who played in five Super Bowls, and very happy that we were able to get this segment book. Shout-out to the great Howard Schatzky out there, who is also agent of our good friend Vernon Turner, the great author and former NFL player from the next level of game I had to play. So I appreciate that they were able to help make this happen and make the connection with the gentleman I'm speaking of, Cornelius Bennett. Again, as I say, I think one of the great defensive players in the NFL the last couple of decades. Cornelius, welcome to the program, sir. Great to have you on. How are you today?
I'm doing great, Rick. Thanks for having me on. It's quite a pleasure.
I'm really happy to be able to do this. And the game of football itself, I guess I would start here. It's a regenerative process every spring. We always get, you know, the green shoots coming up. The guys coming into the league, as you did in 1987 with the NFL draft. And as you're looking at a process like that, obviously, so many great defensive players in this draft. Gentlemen from your alma mater, Alabama, Rashawn Evans going a little later in the first round there, and a tremendous player, I guess, primarily inside, but I know he's played a little bit of outside as well. When you look at him, when you look at some of the other guys coming into the league, I'm just curious, do any of them kind of remind you of yourself as far as how you played the game and what your talents were versus the talents of some of these guys today?
I'm be honest with you, you know, I'm not much of a football fan anymore, but Rashawn, he's a fine football player, and a kid from Georgia, I had a chance to watch him play firsthand against my son's team at the University of Tennessee, and I think he's a very multi-talented football player. You know, he has the size and the speed that, if necessary, I think he could be a dual-threat linebacker. But the last person that I really thought that kind of was similar to me was Clowney.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he's more of an end to me than a linebacker, but as far as you know, talent wise, you know, I kind of put him in that category. But again, you know, the game has changed so much, and the kids are not asked to do as much as when I was playing. But you know, there's some fine football players out there. I like the other kid. I don't know where he went in the draft, but what is it, Sky?
Yeah.
He's from South Florida.
Yes.
I watched him play a little bit, and I like his game. I thought he should have been a higher draft pick going into the draft, but, you know, for some reason, you know, he doesn't fit the eye. I guess a typical NFL linebacker, but I thought he was a fine football player in college.
Yeah, that's the thing, and you're right. That's one of the ways that the game has changed today, is that it is so system-dependent as far as how some of these teams operate and how they want the players to fit into the scheme. And I would co-sign 100% on what you said about Roquan Smith. I think coming out of Georgia and looking as great as he did in what was ultimately a losing effort in the national championship game, but I think he's going to be great nonetheless. And appreciate when you were talking about there, when you're talking SEC, the reference to your son there about Tennessee. I'm a big Vols fan myself, so it's great to see that program looks to be turning around under new leadership.
Definitely, you know, they're gonna take some lumps, some bumps, and you know, and might not be this year, might not be next year, but I think just being at the spring game a month or so ago, I saw vast improvements from last season. Not that the guys last year, it's just a will, having a will to want to be good, and I don't know how much that desire or that will was there with some of the kids. And I think, you know, they had a lot of talent. You know, you get kids drafted or get signed as free agents, and when you have, to me, more than four or five guys that's able to go to the next level, to me, that's a heck of a lot of talent on the football team. So, you know, just trying to hone that talent and get everybody going in the right direction with a sense of urgency, I never saw that last year. But the spring game, Coach Pruitt had guys where they're supposed to be, even though I think that, you know, still missing a few pieces to the puzzle, but I think the team is going to be vastly improved next year, and I'm looking forward to it. I know my son, he's excited because he'll, you know, right now he's running second team, and hopefully, you know, he'll get a chance to play a lot this year and contribute. He had a pretty good spring game, in my opinion, but I'm not in the coach's room with them, listening to them talk or whatever, but from my eye, sitting in the stands, I thought he had a pretty good spring game.
Well, obviously, yeah, you're definitely a guy who can watch that and obviously know what he's talking about and be able to diagnose these things. And, yeah, I'm very hopeful as a fan for this new coaching staff. And not to bring up a painful memory, but I think I happened to be going through Knoxville at what was actually rock bottom last year, because I go down to Atlanta a lot of times for the holidays, coming back through town, listening to the Vanderbilt game as it was happening.
Oh, yeah.
Oh boy,
yeah.
Cornelius, that was, I mean, the radio announcer sounded suicidal. So, I mean, to come from that point to where they are now just has to be such hopefulness right at this moment.
No doubt about it. It was painful to sit and watch. But, you know, growing pains are, you know, that's part of life and, you know, in the real world. And for those kids who will be there in the future, they're going to always remember this 4-8 season they had last year and not want to have to experience that again. So, you know, the thing with good coaching is you help those kids grow from those experiences and remember those experiences and, you know, take the positives from it and move forward. So, again, looking at the spring game and talking to Coach Pruitt a little bit after the spring game, the things that he's expecting going forward, you know, heading into next season, I'm excited, and he's down, you know, excited, and, you know, with the kids coming in, had a good recruiting class, so he gets some a couple of those young freshmen come in, and some of those junior college transfers and fifth year guys that'll come in that should be able to help. So hopefully, you know, I'm looking at us getting a bowl game, you know, and we'll keep growing from there.
Yeah, I think that would be a very good start coming off of last year and sort of the whole rock bottom season of Coach Jones's era, which didn't go so well. But yeah, that would be a good step up, and there seems to be every reason to expect that. But in terms of the thing about multi-generational football within families, there was a gentleman who'd been on the show a little while ago that I talked to, Chidi Ahanatu, and I asked him. Yeah, do you know him?
Yes, I know very well. Cool. Yeah, our kids, our daughter and one of his sons were in the same class while he was down here in South Florida. So, yeah, I know him very well.
Oh, small world. Okay, well, I asked him about that because his son's playing football too, and he, like you, has had a concern about the toll that football takes. And I know I've read up about you and about wanting to make your body available for study after you're passed on, and so he had some of the same concerns about his career as well. So when I asked him about, well, what do you think about your son playing, he pointed to advancements in football safety as a reason that he doesn't feel quite the level of concern about it that you might otherwise think in terms of the toll it took on him. Do you kind of look at it the same way and think, well, at least my son is playing in a safer day and age?
No doubt about it. And I've happened to be very much involved. I was very much involved in helping change the way the game is played, or you know, the practices are going. I in 2011, when we were going through the lockout and you know, strategizing about, you know, the safety of the game or whatever, and how the NFL, everything has to be a trickle-down effect from the NFL as far as how practices are you know, are held and everything. So sitting in those meeting rooms, talking with the health and safety guys or whatever about what we thought was a good way to help make the game safer, you know, reducing the contact in practices, because most injuries, significant injuries, happen in practice. You know, you're banging every day for 2.5-3 hours a pop. Unlike in a game, you know, it's kind of limited to you know, 65-70 plays a day. But you know, you had the 2-a-days, full pads. So that's you know, 180 plus plays, and not counting one on ones where you're still going helmet to helmet kind of thing, whatever. So knowing that, and talking to the doctors back then, that you know, if you can reduce the amount of head contact, the game definitely be safer in itself. And then, you know, trying to get with the helmet manufacturers, I'm trying to create, you know, better product for the kids to wear, unlike, you know, what I played or before me. But that's, you know, that's advancements in technology in itself, and also the advancements in the game. You know, the kids are bigger, stronger, faster, and just like, you know, the league trying to come up with how to curtail the big impacts on kickoffs and kickoff returns or whatever. I don't know if eliminate kickoff from the game, because to me that's a big part of the game, and guys have made tremendous livelihoods on, especially one of my teammates who's still in football now as an announcer, Steve Tassel, to me the greatest special team player in the world. You know, had it not been for special teams running out on kickoffs, you know, we probably would have never heard of Steve Tassel. So I don't think eliminating kickoffs in itself, But looking at ways to make it safer, just like they've done with everything, every other part of the game, as far as like chop blocks and you know, hitting defenseless receivers and all that stuff, that's part of the evolution of the game, and especially as far as making it safer, I'm all for it. And as far as my son is concerned, the day that he said that he wanted to play football, I never not said no, son, because the game is not safe, because I was actually involved in health and safety, and I saw it sitting at his practice and how practice had changed when he was playing you know, football in junior high school and high school, and knowing that the coaches were trying to look out for the kids and making sure the game was safe. So I don't have any concerns with him playing, and I do think waiting a little longer. I waited till he was about 10, 11, I think it was, before I let him play tackle football. I let him play flag football up until then. I do think, you know, I'm waiting a little bit longer, letting the brain develop a little bit more is important. But other than that, you know, that's what he wants to do. And because I can't take his dream away from him. You know, nobody took mine away from me. And so I got to let him live his life.
Well, you raised several interesting points, and I definitely want to draw down on this a little bit further with you, because from your perch as somebody who played football at such a high level, and going back to being one of the last athletes recruited by Bear Bryant before he retired, I know you didn't get to play for him, but I know that was part of the recruitment process on through the 80s, into the NFL, into the 90s. How would you characterize then versus now in terms of, we hear cliches about rub some dirt on it, or I got my bell rung, or that kind of stuff that you would hear. I mean, in terms of a word that you would pick to use of then versus now, in terms of knowledge and awareness of these subjects, would it be very tiny? Would it be moderately small? It can't be that big. How much knowledge was there relative to right now?
I think that from being involved, like I said, and sitting in rooms and listening and reading and the doctors that the NFL had, I think the knowledge was definitely, you know, definitely, I would say superior. They had superior knowledge on the effects of concussion, as you can see by the NFL selling the concussion lawsuit. You know, didn't want to be exposed as far as turning over documents or what have you. So the knowledge was definitely there. But I think, in a sense, though, as far as how, you know, it's viewed by the NFL now, I think because the public is so involved in it, and it does threaten the game in some sort, because parents are pulling their kids away from football. And so the league had to, when you do something with the league, you almost have to shame them into doing something, making a correction. And I think it was a shameful situation, especially when you see guys stepping out on faith as far as putting their public lives, their private lives in the public eye, as far as telling, the public that they have, some issues with their memories or what have you. So the knowledge was definitely there. Doing something about it was in a sense, just like any other injury, they want you back on the field as soon as possible. And as far as rubbing the dirt on it, you hit the nail on the head. Guys on the sideline, you shook it off, took a few Advil or what have you. And if you were able to go back in, you went back in and you just dealt with the after effects after the game, because you're going to be hurting somewhere. And sometimes it just happened to be a lingering headache for a few days. And you didn't think much about it because there was no talk from the doctors or the trainers about it. He got a concussion, but he should be fine in a couple of days. And in a couple of days, that's what you expect, to be fine in a couple of days and ready to go the following Sunday. So, and that was, that was from orthopedic doctors and trainers, not neurologists, talking about that. So we've remedied that problem with having neurologists on the sideline now. The concussion protocol, all that stuff. All of that came out of 2011, the last CBA, to where, we made sure that from a union standpoint that we were going to make sure that our guys are protected the best way we know how to protect them. And that's, using our 1,500 guys in the league, the product, the union, make sure that the owners understood that our players' health and safety was concern number one.
You made an excellent distinction in answering my question. I didn't even think about it until after I asked the question, but in terms of how primitive the knowledge was now versus then, I'm looking at it from a public standpoint, but as you say, the NFL certainly knew more than they were letting on. So that's a very interesting and very critical distinction, that while the public knowledge on the subject was extraordinarily primitive, unfortunately the NFL had more information that they didn't do enough to share with you guys. That's a great point.
Definitely. We've moved on from that.
Yes.
The lawsuit, again, was settled. And although, guys are getting monetary rewards, although at a very slow pace, it doesn't give guys their health back or anything like that, but it does make life a little bit easier for the guys that are receiving awards. And but we've, like I said, we've moved on. We've made the game safer. We've made it more, I guess, put the onus on the players themselves as well. Guys, like in my time, would just say, I'm fine or whatever, shake it off, whatever, try to go back in. Now we're holding each other responsible. You're holding each other accountable as far as telling the truth, whether or not you're up or down, as far as, your head injuries or what have you. Almost, like the buddy system in the military, that was something that was brought to attention at one of the conferences. Sitting there, there's a buddy system, and so you find your buddy and you guys hold each other accountable, man, yes or no, are you all right? And you have to be truthful, just like the team, the same thing. It's you looking me in the eye, I'm looking at you in the eye across the huddle, and I know you got my back, and you know I have your back, kind of thing. So that part of it has changed as well. So these kids now, especially like with my son, it's going to be commonplace where, guys are asking each other, hey, bro, you all right, kind of thing. Now, in my time, guys would keep certain injuries to themselves and wouldn't sell them, wouldn't even tell the trainers. They would go home and self-medicate or self-treat themselves or what have you. But now, we've gotten that out the way. We've cleared the way for guys to be, upfront and honest about what's truly wrong with them or how they truly feel.
Well, in terms of the evolution of the game, this is something that's been talked about a lot from a safety standpoint. When you're getting into some of the purest demolition derby elements of football, I think you'd have to put special teams up there. And there's a consensus out there that purely from a safety point of view, whether it be kickoff returns, I suppose you couldn't do away with punt returns because that'd be changing the game too much. But it's very interesting in talking to your old teammate, my friend Vernon Turner, talking about that. Obviously, he is somebody who feels extraordinarily strongly because this is a guy who made his paycheck on special teams, on returns in the league, and he's saying that's going to put guys like me out of business. So,
That's exactly right.
You know, and that's the funny thing is that when you're looking at it, and it's almost a thing, too, when you're looking at the trade-offs of sports, you know, similar to boxing or MMA or whatever, you can look at it and say, gee, this is inhumane or whatever the case may be, however you might think about it. But at the end of the day, every time you do away with something, in this case, if it is the return game in football, you're putting guys out of work potentially. So that's a side of the spectrum that really doesn't seem to get thought about much, Cornelius.
Only to the guys that live in those, you know, in that life, you know, the Lorenzo Alexander, who's with the Buffalo Bills, who's made his career being a special teammate. Again, you said Vernon was a teammate, and I mentioned to me the greatest special team player of all time, Steve Tasker. And then you look at Devin Hester and guys like that who made their living at it. Yes, let's make it safer. And I read something today, just happened to be reading something today about the potential rule changes next week at the league meetings in Atlanta on some of the suggestions or what have you. And you know, they always tinkering like they tinkered a few years ago with the, you know, the extra point. Well, let's tinker till we get it right and not eliminate it altogether, because it does make a difference to guys making a team or not, especially free agent kids coming out of college. You know, every kid and every coach will tell kids in the first meetings probably, you want to make the team, be good on special teams. You know, that's not an easy way, because there's no easy way to make an NFL team, but that's a surefire way. If you're a good special team player, that they'll make room for you and develop you as a position player otherwise. So, you know, I played with guys who played 10, 11, 12 years, and all they did was special teams. Ever Shelley, when I was in Atlanta, you know, but 10-year, 11-year career, special teams age. So, I mean, you go look at the history of the game, you have some special guys who play special teams. You look at Slater in New England right now.
Yep.
I mean, he had been tremendous this whole career, and it's all on special teams. Otherwise, you wouldn't know that who his father is, that he plays in the NFL. So you can't eliminate it. I just to me, it almost turned into like a watching the spring game as far as lining up or overtime period or something, lining up at the 35-yard line and going from there, because the excitement of the game is watching Deion Sanders take one to the house, you know, from 100 yards. You know, that kind of, I mean, that's part of the excitement of NFL football.
It is. It's a core part of the excitement. And again, and it's funny, you've mentioned a couple times there Steve Tasker. I always get a kick out of the story of Vernon showing Steve the picture in the book where Steve just lit him up on a tackle.
I remember that game. I remember that game. Vernon was, you know, he had gotten released from us, I guess, or we didn't re-sign him. Uh-huh. And he went to the Rams, and he was a little bit exuberant coming back to Buffalo or whatever. And I think it was the opening kickoff for the game, and it was just it was kind of no contest, but it was great for Vernon because, again, now he's still living his dream playing in the NFL. So you eliminate that. You won't have that kind of picture. A player won't have that kind of memory like Vernon has.
Exactly. And we've had a debate topic on this show previously. I'd love to get your thoughts on this because I've used Steve Tasker as an example of this, and I kind of lump him in with some of the great coordinators that we've seen in the NFL, whether it be a Jim Johnson, a Monty Kiffin, etc. In my estimation, if you were the very best at what you were, whether it was a special teams player, a coordinator offensively or defensively, I think that's Hall of Fame worthy. So is that something in your estimation that Steve Tasker, I look at him and I say, hey, Hall of Fame, because as you said, arguably the greatest of all time, and I know you've said the greatest of all time, at what he did. To me, we should be in the line of awarding excellence no matter where it comes from. What are your thoughts on that?
And no doubt about it. I mean, but you look at the kickers, you know, until last year, you know, with Morton, who's a former teammate, Morton Anderson, until then, whether, you know, Rapper Nurska is the only other kicker in the NFL Hall of Fame, but you've had so many great kickers for so long. So, yes, I do think, you know, if you play a position on the football field, regardless what position it is, and you're the best at it, and you get voted by your peers, by fans, and by coaches as the best over an extended period of time, definitely you should have a chance to be in the Hall of Fame, because it's football. It's a football game, not, you know, just offense and defense. It's football, you know, offense, defense, and special teams. So it definitely should be a place for special team aces like Steve.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with you completely. Excellence is excellence no matter where it comes from. And circling around, I'd like to ask you another question that's been posed on this show a couple times previously. This is very much on the theoretical level. I started asking this question of some of our football guests, and I've loved the answers so much I make it a standard thing now. So my question to you is this, just in terms of thinking about the game, where the game may be headed. I'm using Mike Martz as an example here, and I know that he isn't necessarily the inventor of the spread. You've got Mouse Davis, June Jones, etc. But if you're looking at the modern spread in the NFL, I guess I use Mike Martz as sort of shorthand. We haven't had that same degree of creativity defensively, somebody who's come in and really kind of changed the game defensively. So my question to you on a theoretical level, and just whatever you think it might be, whatever it might consist of, is when we get a guy who's the Mike Martz of defense in the NFL, what's your best guess as to what that might look like and the directions that they might go in?
Well, I disagree with you in a sense as far as from a player's perspective, because coaches can only, you know, strategize or whatever.
Sure.
But when you go back and the guy who I was labeled after, and every other outside linebacker since he came in the league, was labeled after, as Lawrence Taylor, and you talk about from a defensive perspective, there's nobody changed the game of defense in the history of the game since the way he did. And although I was a good, representation of it, you know, I still say he's the best, and Derek Thomas, ended up being the best pass rushing outside linebacker, personal outside linebacker in the history of the game, in my opinion. When you have a guy on defense that you can move around and change the game that way, I just it's almost like offense with the kid out of Louisville this year's quarterback. I just think the coaches have to understand that when you have a special person like that, you have to adjust just like you make adjustments during a game. But coaches are so into what they do and how they were taught or whatever. I think that just they're afraid to think outside of the box, except for the fact of Mouse and June back in the day, and Mike Martz. When you have one football and multiple guys on your offensive team, you know, running back Marshall Faulk and then your two receivers that you had in Bruce and the other kid Holt, you have to figure out, you know, you have to change the game plan. You got to change it up because you got. Triple threat, do you know, you got to get the ball to those guys, because anytime you touch the ball, it's a potential touchdown. And on the same on defense, when you have talented guys, you have to move them around, put them in a position to take that one football away or to change the game. And it's just a matter of the coaches, coaching involvement with the players, because the game has changed. You've gone from slow guys, you know, I was, you know, particularly slow, but now everybody's big, strong, and fast. You know, it's almost even across the board when you look at it position by position. So I would look at the coaching changing as far as evolving, because the players have evolved. So, you know, you have the coaches have to evolve with time as well.
That's a great answer about when you have a really great player like that, moving them around a lot. Yeah, I think that kind of greater flexibility on the part of the coaches, that is a great answer. The answer that we've gotten thus far that I think is the most mind-blowing, I believe it was N.D. Kalu who gave the answer on this one here. I think it was him. His thought was three down linemen and then eight more or less interchangeable linebackers and defensive backs and guys just having completely fluid assignments among those eight guys. I was like, wow, that is super futuristic right there. I mean, we might be 50 years off from that, but it's an interesting future to ponder.
Well, no doubt about it, but the athletes, the kids are becoming that athletic, and if it, you know, translates into that, so be it. I mean, like now, coaches are, for some reason, prime example, some reason, now you're getting tight ends that, again, when I say big, strong, and fast, you know, 6'6", 275 running 4.445s, but then you got to put a safety or a cone on them, which is in my opinion is just, you know, just doesn't make sense. And but you do have linebackers that are bigger, stronger, faster than I was when I played. That for some reason coaches are just stuck in keeping them in the box and not, you know, not teaching them the right techniques on how to cover a guy that size, and with that, you know, which is a matchup. But you know, for some reason, when I help kids get ready for the combine or whatever, linebackers or whatever, a few times I've, you know, done some camps or whatever. Kids have no coverage ability whatsoever. Not that they can't, they just never been taught. So again, I think as coaching, teach the kids how to play the game, not just, you know, play position, teach them how to play the game. I mean, when I was growing up, I learned how to play pretty much every position, and it showed when I got on the field. In high school, otherwise, you're going to hear me. I've never heard of me because I was a dual threat, offense, defense, punt, kick, threw. I can throw the ball, everything. But now, you know, kids are so one-dimensional. So get back to teaching the kids. You know, it starts at the grassroots level. But in the NFL, it's a shame to me when I watch the game, and that's why I'm not a big, big fan as far as watching games, because, when, you know, although these guys are great football players or whatever, when there's nobody, a linebacker, safety can't cover this guy, I'm like, oh, come on. And that's every other linebacker that I played with or against. We get together and we like, man, can you believe how they let this guy just release off the ball free, you know, from either down in the box or if he's, you know, split out or what have you, you know. And it blows my mind that the coaches aren't, you know, like, all you have to do is kill the time out of the play. And it takes away that particular player, you know, slow them down a little bit. You don't have to cover them for a long distance of time, you know, long period of time. But if you slow them down coming off the ball, it takes, you know, the ball got to be going in about 3 seconds or the quarterback is going to get killed. So if you can slow them down a little bit, take away the timing, you know, not that they won't catch balls at some point or whatever, but it definitely disrupts the offense. And that's what you have to do. But coaches, for some reason, line up guys deep off the ball, knowing that in a tight game, that big guy, that's who they're going to go to. I mean, the Patriots have been just unbelievable with that. And for some reason, I don't know if coaches are just afraid to challenge Belichick and his coaches doing it or what have you. But it just blows my mind. It blows my mind when I sit and I watch. And everybody that's watching the game know where the ball is going to 87. And he's still allowed to catch the ball and be as good as he, you know, as he's been. I mean, he's a tremendous football player. But I guarantee if you pull him aside and just man to man, you know, in a private conversation, ask him, he's like, dude, I know he'd probably say it's foolish how they let me just, you know, release off the line of scrimmage.
Well,
but he's happy because it's gonna put him in Canton. Antonio Gates is another one. I mean, you know, it's crazy. Everybody knows that the ball is going to go to the big guy, and yet and still they let him release off the line of scrimmage free and clear with a chance to get his big hand, big body position to receive the ball. It doesn't make sense to me.
Well, yeah, everything about fundamentals, that is a common lament of today's game and players being fundamentally lacking in a lot of ways. And, yeah, to bring everything full circle here, I know that I talked to you off air, and I guess we just unfortunately missed the ability here on the show to be able to promote this, but I know that you've always got events going on in terms of giving back to the future of football and the youngsters that are coming up in the game. So anything you'd like to mention with that you're involved in, please take it away.
I was on the board a long time with our Players Association as a board member and as chairman for two terms, and I'm very proud that my heart and my mind tells me to give back and help make the game a better game as far as from a player's perspective, you know, being involved with our union, you know, making sure that our older guys are being taken care of. And then on the flip side, you know, I host a couple of charity golf events, one here in South Florida that benefits the North Miami Police Athletic League. And I just hosted my 8th annual golf tournament in Birmingham, Alabama, my hometown, that benefits the Children's Village of Birmingham, Alabama. That's, you know, that helps out children in distress, boys and girls. There's a Christian youth home there. And I'm just delighted that we've been able to celebrate 8 years of doing that. And I think here in South Florida, the tournament, we've had 3 or 4 years here with this tournament here. So it does, you know, it is life-changing for some of the kids. And I'm just so grateful that I have a platform to be able to, you know, produce those two products and make a difference in the community.
Well, that's great that you're doing that, Cornelius, really leveraging the tremendous career that you had, because I have to tell you that there are teams that people are on that are just such a part of a special moment in time. And those Bills teams that you were on that went to 4 Super Bowls in a row, I'm sitting here in America's North Coast, Cleveland, Ohio, but I'll tell you, I know people in this town that are fans of the Bills, and particularly who rooted for you guys back during that period of time. One of our show contributors, Anthony Patrone, the wife of one of our show contributors, Bob Benick, he's also my fantasy football commissioner. I see this every year when I go down in his rec room, because his wife is a huge Bills fan. There's a 1990 team picture there. I've actually took a zoom up of Vernon's face and texted it to him. But, I mean, you know, you guys made such an impression on people. Obviously not just in Buffalo, but that was a team that people all over the place rooted for. Myself, as much as I loathe the Cowboys, I would root for you guys in the Super Bowl. So, you know, you guys made such an impression on people all over the place, and having the great career that you did, it's especially admirable to be giving back at this point in time.
Well, thank you. And one more thing. Today my best friend from the Bills and former teammate Thurman Thomas, the Bills announced that they are going to retire his number 34 jersey. So I'm excited and pleased and can't wait to the Monday night game in November when they do such a thing, because it's going to be a tremendous time and all getting back together with my old teammates. And the Cleveland fans, when the team left, there used to be busloads of Cleveland Browns fans coming up to Buffalo, supporting the Buffalo Bills, and I remember that. And O.J. McDuffie, who's a Miami Dolphin guy, but he's from Cleveland. His mom in particular, I remember his mother, she's passed away now, but coming up and hanging out actually at the mobile home that I used to have at the game. So, yes, the Cleveland, you know, the fans there are true Eastern fans of Buffalo and Cleveland, so it kind of goes hand in hand, man.
Exactly. And, you know, we've certainly had it rougher over the last several decades. But, yeah, there's a lot of commonality between the football fan bases and the cities. No question about
And
Buffalo's, it's a great sports town. I've been up there. I even got to take a tour one time of the Bison's stadium. And, again, they really support whether it's the AAA baseball team or as much as they love the hockey team. And yeah, it's a tremendous sports town, and you got to be a part of something very special there. And, again, as I said, I was really looking forward to this conversation and talking football with you today, Cornelius. Please don't be a stranger. Love to catch up with you as we go along here and talk some more football with you. But thank you so much for making time for us today.
Thank you for having me on. And you have my contact information, so text at me and let me know, and hopefully I can join you again.
Absolutely. I look forward to that. Thank you so much, Cornelius. Thank you, everybody, for joining us today for FDH Lounge Mini Episode number 987.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Aquafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.